stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion. Glad that you are with us on this Wednesday afternoon. This program is for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Perhaps you are new to EWTN. Maybe you yourself are not a Catholic. And yet, you've got questions about the Catholic faith. We can answer those questions. Here is our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us outside of North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, and when you get that response from us, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can always send us an email 24/7. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Vanessa Sanchez is handling phone screening today. Rich Jesse on social media. He's keeping an eye on YouTube and Facebook. If you're listening on one of those platforms, you can ask a question via the comments box. Just put your question right there. Rich will take care of it at that point. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. Are you hydrated?
That I am. I can say that.
Gotta be.
Yep.
Gotta be.
Staying hydrated.
Weather like this. Interesting question here from Larry. He says, Dr. David Anders, what is your response to this? This is a quote that he's sharing. He says, critics of the pre-tribulation rapture view argue that this view began in the 1800s with John Nelson Darby. Is this true? And what do the church fathers say going back to the 1st and 4th centuries AD? Are pre-trib proponents taking historical quotes out of context?
Yes, pre-trib proponents are taking historical quotes out of context. So what you can find in the first three centuries is documented evidence of chiliasm. Chiliasm is the belief that there will be, or millennialism, is the belief that there will be a literal thousand-year reign of Christ on earth.
Okay.
And that you can find that in antiquity, all right? That's not what's at issue. That's not what's at issue with the pre-tribulation rapture people. There's a much more elaborate eschatology, a much more elaborate construal of biblical history that's implied in the pre-tribulation rapture doctrine. In particular, it's this idea that Jesus comes three times, not just twice, that there's a secret coming in medio res, you know, where in the middle of time when he takes the church out of time and space and history.
Uh-huh.
Then there's a tribulation for 7 years, and then Jesus comes back at the end of that time, brings the church with him, then sets up this millennial kingdom. And it's not just any old millennial kingdom. It's a millennial kingdom with a decidedly sort of Hebrew-Jewish flair, and there's a reconstruction of the Jewish temple and the reinitiation of Jewish sacrifices.
Wow.
There's a whole lot that goes into classical dispensationalism that most people have in mind when they talk about the rapture doctrine.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons why fundamentalists in North America are so so uncritically pro-Israel in their foreign policy. Regardless of what you think about events on the ground in Gaza or anything like that, they have a theological motive because they think that the nation state of Israel is implicated in end times prophecy and that the fate of the nation is somehow connected to the return of Jesus. All that, none of that's in antiquity. None of that's in Christian antiquity. The only thing you can find in Christian antiquity is the idea that there would in fact be a thousand-year millennial reign on earth.
Wow. It's very imaginative, though, you know? It really is. All that is like, and then this. Well, okay. Where are you getting all that? Man, oh, man.
Yep.
Okay. Well, Larry, yeah, thank you so much. This is an interesting email here from Lourdes. Dr. Anders, I was telling my brother that gambling is a sin against God's commandment, thou shalt not steal. My brother engages in gamecock fighting. He rationalizes that he takes care of his game rooster, buys chicken feeds and vitamins with his own money. he can't comprehend the kind of sin committed in such an act. I said that the fact that he wastes his money on betting is considered a sin, as there is no difference in gambling with 1 cent or $10,000. He disagrees with me. Can you help? Please help me explain this to him. Thanks again, Lourdes.
Well, actually, Lourdes, I'm going to have to split the difference between the two of you, right?
Okay.
Because the Catholic Church does not teach that it is always and everywhere a sin to gamble. It does not see that.
Okay.
And there is a difference between, say, somebody betting on a friendly poker game on a Friday night, on the one hand, which could just be a form of entertainment. And sometimes people find, I'm not among them, and sometimes people find games and sports more compelling or interesting when there's something at stake on the table, you know, and then there is that personality. But that's not the same. That's not to say that all gambling is okay, because there is a pathological form of gambling where a person beggars themselves or their family, or you know, can waste their time, and it can become quite obsessive and wasteful, when it would become a grave sin if they're harming themselves or harming their family, then it can be gravely wrong. Now, you know, there's the church also says that cruelty to animals is in principle wrong. And so, you know, there's another objection to gamecock fighting that has nothing to do with gambling per se. I mean, just kind of like bear baiting and these other sports that involve cruelty to animals.
Uh-huh.
But you know, to the extent that this is an obsessive behavior on his part that in fact makes his family situation worse off, then that is problematic. But if he's just betting a few pennies on the occasional I would say, you know, tete-a-tete, but maybe it's beak-a-beak.
Oh, boy.
That's a different story.
All right. Lourdes, thank you so much for your email. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, we're glad to get it. And we try to answer as many emails as we can. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. We try to take care of a couple of emails on each one of our live shows. And then once a month or so, we'll shake out the mailbag and get as many emails as we can during one of our regular shows. Again, ctc@ewtn.com. All right, calls are coming in right now. In a moment, we're going to get to Andrew in Roanoke, Virginia. Lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, maybe you'd like to ask, or we would ask you, what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Especially if you're tuning in for the first time and you're going, Catholicism, I don't know about that. Well, what's keeping you from becoming a Catholic? 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. Love to chat with you today. 833-288-3986 if you have a question about the Catholic faith. Great new book available from EWTN Publishing, I Will Come to You, A Story of Adoption and the Relentless Love of God by Jamie McAleer. You can journey with Jamie through her experiences of understanding adoption and then her very personal journey to Russia to find and bring home the son that God had chosen for her. What a book. I Will Come to You, The Story of Adoption and the Relentless Love of God by Jamie McAleer. It's available right now at EWTNRC.com. Buy Catholic. Shop EWTNRC.com. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Beginning today with Andrew in Roanoke, listening to us on YouTube. Hey there, Andrew. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hello. Me and a friend of mine are both lay Dominicans. I'm a postulant. She's a temporary promise. And she's considering discerning out. And she sees this tension because she's an Eastern Catholic. And she's very fond of the spirituality of Saint Ephrem. And she's has like a tent. There's a tension between the theology of Saint Thomas Aquinas and the spirituality in Syriac Catholicism. And I was wondering if any kind of advice you would have for her.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, she is of course not obligated to become a lay Dominican, right? And that spirituality is not for everyone. She's also not obligated as a Catholic to adhere to Thomism. Thomism is a philosophical school within the Catholic intellectual tradition. It's an important philosophical school. It is not the only philosophical school, and one is not obligated to be a Thomist. One is not obligated to be a Thomist. And when Pope John Paul II wrote Fides et Ratio, his encyclical on faith and reason, he made it clear that the Church does not make any particular philosophical school normative. It respects Thomas, but it respects other paths in philosophy as well, and particularly nods to the Eastern tradition. Uh-huh. So she's not obligated to reconcile her beliefs with Thomism. Now, that being said, there's more than one way to read St. Thomas. And you know, I don't know what formation she's been getting in her particular lay Dominican community, but it's not uncommon to be given a kind of one-sided approach to Thomas that maybe doesn't incorporate the fullness of the angelic doctor's background and interests and the breadth of his thought and experience in reading. And there is definitely a way of reading St. Thomas that is more amenable to, say, an Eastern disposition. I mean, in particular, modern scholarship on Thomas has really, really underscored not just the Aristotelian bases of his thought, but the Neoplatonic ones, particularly as they have been transmitted by Dionysius and by Proclus. And, I mean, these are very Eastern thinkers whose thought is equally important for understanding the Cappadocians and Maximus and others of that ilk, right? Uh-huh. Not so much Ephraim, but definitely the Eastern tradition.
Okay.
So, you know, I don't know, you know, how heavy a study she wants to get involved in, but the now deceased historian of philosophy Wayne Hankey has, Hankey, has a number of books on Thomas and the influence of Neoplatonism on his thought and ways of approaching Thomas that would be a more amenable to that kind of thing. So, I mean, that's a sort of first order of business. That's what comes to me right off the top of my head. But again, you know, at the end of the day, she's not obligated to be either a Dominican or a Thomist. And we're all about St. Ephraim. And so if she wants to snuggle into her Syriac identity and say, you know what, I'm just with Ephraim all the way, No objections from us. You know, we Latin Catholics, we're all about that. So, you know, have at it.
The faith of both and.
There you go.
All right. Andrew, is that helpful for you?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
We do appreciate your phone call from Roanoke. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. It is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on EWTN. All right, let's go now to Tom. Tom is calling in from Twinsburg, Ohio, listening on the great Living Bread Radio. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
My understanding is that even outside of Lent, Fridays are days of penance, and I've tried various penances that haven't worked out well for one reason or another. I'm trying now. I'm giving up a soda pop. I live in a retirement home. They give us the meat or whatever they give, and I only make a problem of it during Lent, and it's a problem. But I mean, I try various things that. So I'm trying giving up soda pop now. But is Friday of every day outside of Lent a day of penance? Because I tell that to Catholics and they look at me like I've got a flower growing out of my head. And would giving up soda pop be a good penance?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So the Church tells us that during Lent, we are required to abstain from meat on Fridays. If it's not Lent, we do not have to abstain from meat, but we are asked to do something in acknowledgement of our Lord's crucifixion. And that is going to be very particular based on the person and their needs and disposition. If in your life you drink too much soda pop and you think that's a problem, that maybe you need to rein that in a bit, and remembering our Lord's Passion on Friday is an occasion for you to do that, and you think that would be helpful, there's, of course, no objection to your doing that, right?
Yeah,
I mean, for somebody else, you know, like, I don't really drink soda pop very much. It's not a big part of my life, and so giving it up on Fridays would, you know, it's not really a big deal, you know? I mean,
but for you, it might be something else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It would be something else for me, you know? Actually, I like medjool dates. And they're not particularly bad for you. They're fairly good for you. But, I mean, I can eat too many of them. I really can. I can gorge medjool dates. And, you know, if I had to say, well, no medjool dates on Friday, that'd be, you know, I usually eat at least a day today. And that would be a bit of a penance for me.
There you go. Tom, thanks so much for your call from Twinsburg, Ohio. And there's still time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. Really just getting started on this Wednesday afternoon.
Do you remember when we had the radio conference in Phoenix, Arizona?
Yes.
No, it wasn't Phoenix. It wasn't Phoenix. I'm sorry. I did see medjool dates in Phoenix. They're dropping off the trees in Phoenix. I remember I was walking down the sidewalk, and I looked down. There's a date on the ground. I went, where'd that date come from? And look up, and there's a date palm over my head. Like,
wow.
We don't have dates falling out of the sky in Birmingham.
No.
But I had the opportunity to speak in El Centro, California one time for the Catholic radio.
Oh, yeah.
There was a date farmer out there. And after my talk, his wife came up to me with, like, bags of medjool dates. And, like,
whoa.
Take as many as you can fit in your suitcase. And I went, you've got to be kidding me. This is heaven on earth.
Wow.
See, don't give me a check. Just give me medjool dates.
The benefits of Catholic radio are quite numerous.
Unbelievable.
833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-3986. Here's an email that we received from... Hebway, I believe is how that is pronounced. And Hebway says, my friend Rob thinks Mary committed sin at least once because he says the wages of sin is death and everyone is short of the glory of God. My friend used to be a Baptist. Now he is Calvary Chapel. Can you help my friend Rob and Dr. Anders? Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, I'm not exactly sure how he gets from the wages of sin is death to the Blessed Virgin Mary sinned. Because you might be aware there's a tradition in the West that Mary didn't die. Right? That she was assumed into heaven without death.
Good point.
Now, in the East, they actually do acknowledge the Blessed Virgin's death. They call it her Dormition.
Dormition.
But they also have a doctrine of the Assumption, right? Predicated on the idea that as the Mother of God, as the Theotokos, she was graced with extraordinary graces, and she is the all-holy, all-pure one who never sinned, right? So it's a commonplace of Christian theology going back to the beginning that Our Lady was without stain of any kind. And nothing your friend has asserted demonstrates that that's not the case.
Yep, there you go. And thank you so much for your email. Emma is watching us in Los Angeles today on YouTube. Emma says, I am a breast cancer survivor. I'm thinking about doing reconstruction. Is this too similar to what transgender people are doing to their bodies? I want to ensure I'm not doing anything that violates Catholic teaching.
Oh, Emma, thank you so much. First of all, I am so sorry that you've had to go through this trial. That's got to be just absolutely devastating and difficult. I can't even imagine. So my heart goes out to you, and our prayers go out to you as well. You are not violating any aspect of Catholic teaching, right? And the Catholic Church's position on medical intervention is that whenever you do something that is to restore or enhance or construct or fix or facilitate the natural functioning of the human body as God made it, you're cooperating with grace, I mean, with nature here, right?
Sure.
And, you know, since God makes women to have two breasts, through some tragedy they lose one and you reconstruct one, you're really cooperating with nature here. You're restoring things to their natural integrity as best you can. There's really nothing contrary to Catholic faith. In fact, that's quite consonant with Catholic faith. And, you know, I mean, you could have a Catholic plastic surgeon who gave his or her life to nothing but reconstructing breasts for women who suffered breast cancer.
Sure.
And I think that could be a tremendously meritorious thing for a Catholic physician to do. So, you know, we wish you the best and I hope in your recovery, and please go forward with a clean conscience.
Emma, thanks for checking in from LA via YouTube. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Back to the phones now at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Anne in Michigan, listening on the great Ave Maria radio. Hello, Anne. What's on your mind today? Anne in Michigan, are you there?
Yes.
Go right ahead, Anne.
Yes, I'd like to know if eating meat on Friday is a mortal or a venial sin, and why did they stop ringing the bells during the consecration at Mass, and why did they eliminate the confiteor? None of these churches in Bay City say the confiteor at Mass.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the question. First of all, of course, we're only required to abstain from meat on Fridays during Lent. So outside of Lent, there is no requirement to abstain from meat. If a person were to eat meat on a Friday during Lent, you know, that could be more or less grave depending on their state of mind, right? And so it's possible for a person to thoughtlessly eat meat. You know, I mean, I've certainly forgotten that it was a liturgical feast before. Some feast hits and, you know, I've got some obligation and, you know, 5 o'clock rolls around and you go, ah, today was a holy day. I can't believe I missed that one. You know, and we've all had days like that. Sure. And obviously that's not intentional. That's
right,
not
right.
intentional. So there's no fault there at all, except just being absent-minded, and that's not a sin, right?
Right.
You know, now imagine if, say, the priest got up at Good Friday services and began his homily by saying, I got to tell you guys about the barbecue I had for lunch today, right? I mean, like, he has a grave obligation not only to follow the church's teaching and laws, but to exemplify that to the people and to be, to really set an example of what Catholic life should look like. Obviously, his sin would be that much more grave, right? Because it would be kind of an obstinate refusal, you know, knowing better and with a grave, his person, his whole office is oriented towards the liturgical structure of the church, and that would really be grave. And then I think you can kind of imagine a sliding scale of gravity there. Now, with any sin, the church doesn't really draw a line and say, if you do this, you're in mortal sin. If you do that, you're in venial sin. Because while you can talk about the objective gravity of an act, like murder is always terrible, right? You can't know precisely the state of mind of the person doing it. Like somebody could kill someone else, but maybe they're not in their right mind, right? Well, that would lessen the gravity of the act. So the church says, this is really wrong, but we're going to let God decide, you know, judge the individual soul.
Sure.
So that's why I would take that.
Okay. And then regarding ringing the bells?
Oh, yeah. So, well, certainly the ringing bells during consecration has not stopped in the Catholic Church. And most of the churches I go to around here, they're just ringing all day, bud. It's just ringing off the hook, right? You know, lots of ringing around here, okay?
Yeah.
And same with the Confiteor. You know, we say the Confiteor a lot. And so, I mean, there could be individual parishes or dioceses where that's less common. Why would it be less common? Well, you know, I can only guess. I can only venture a guess. And I could have, you know, so it might be that, and I'm trying to put a charitable construction on this, okay?
Okay.
The church teaches us that that the sacrifice of the Mass, while it properly exists at the moment of the consecration, it incorporates the entirety of the Mass from the introit to the dismissal. Like, the whole thing is the rite of sacrifice. And so, you know, one ought to be present for the whole thing. And I could imagine, and I'm not defending this point of view, you understand. I'm trying to sympathetically articulate what someone might say as a reason not to ring bells. And
okay.
I'm not necessarily approving that decision.
Yeah.
Someone might say, you know, by ringing the bells, we're isolating, like, the highlight of the Mass, to be sure, but maybe we're drawing people's minds away from the integrity of the entire rite,
mm-hmm.
and maybe we want to discourage the whole, like, show up 5 minutes before the consecration, take communion, and run out the door attitude, right? And that's a problem, right?
Oh,
that is
yeah.
a real problem of people who come late, leave early, you know, take communion, and then really ignore the other parts of the Mass altogether. And that's not the proper disposition, right? So maybe someone says, well, you know, we're trying to discourage that. And if we ring the bell, then maybe they think, well, all I got to do is make it by the bell, and then I'm good, you know? and so we want to lay off the bell. I could see someone saying that. I could find maybe less charitable construals of that position as well. Is that the right thing to do? Well, it's really the bishop's call. That's the priest's call. It's not my call. You know, I'm pretty good with bells. I like the bells.
Love the bells.
And we got lots of bells. We have lots of bells here at EWTN. Watch the Mass on EWTN. You're going to hear lots of bells.
Definitely. And thanks so much for your call from Michigan. Hey, lines are open for you. We've still got 30 minutes to go on this program. 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Call to communion here on EWTN on this Wednesday afternoon. Glad that you're with us. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We'll get back to the phones in a second. Hard for me to believe. It's been 11 years since Father Benedict Groeschel passed away. Thinking about him today on his what would have been the 92nd anniversary of his birth. You know, Father Groeschel, he wrote over 45 books, including books like The Courage to be Chaste, Arise from Darkness, that's all about depression. And there was one called After This Life, a meditation on death and the afterlife. He's an amazing man. Some of the things you may not have known, he co-founded the Trinity Retreat House. That is a retreat house for troubled priests. That was back in 1973. In 1976, he helped Saint Mother Teresa establish her order in New York. One other thing to point out here, back in 1980, he helped Father John Harvey set up the ministry Courage. This is a ministry for Catholic men struggling with homosexual attraction. An amazing man. We do remember him, and we hope that you remember him as well. Let's go now to Twyla. She is a first-time caller from Billings, Montana, listening on the great Billings Catholic Radio. Twyla, what's on your mind today?
Hi. So I just had a quick question. So if you commit a mortal sin and you confess to your priest, do you have to continue to ask forgiveness?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So no, you do not. And Christ's promise that he would put our sins as far away from him as the east is from the west is opposite here, right? So you would not need to continue to do that. And in my judgment, it could be a very bad thing to continue to run that over and over again, right? Because a lot of times we'll have an experience where we do something wrong and, you know, we kind of traumatize ourselves. You know, all sin is harmful in some respect. Maybe we harmed ourselves, maybe we harmed somebody else. And that leaves an imprint on your brain and your emotional life. And that can come back and sort of bite you, you know, in a sort of traumatic memory. And there can be a temptation to turn that into an occasion for self-blame, right? And to go, oh, I'm a bad person. I'm a terrible guy. Oh, I did this horrible thing. And really kind of beat yourself up. And that experience of psychological guilt, which is something different entirely from the kind of moral guilt that we incur when we wrong somebody, but the psychological experience of guilt really doesn't help advance us in charity or the life of the virtues at all. I mean, the thing that helps that is encouragement, right? When I think that I can accomplish something for God and for my neighbor, then I move forward and I grow in grace and holiness. But if I'm just beating myself and hating on myself all the time, then I don't. I really don't advance in the spiritual life or emotionally or in relationships at all. So really lean into those words of absolution. When you hear the priest say, I absolve you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You put that thing behind you, go forward with a bright face on and don't ever confess it again. You know, I had a spiritual director for a while. He's kind of a half friend, half spiritual director, wise old Dominican priest. And when I had been Catholic, not too long, I made an appointment to see him and do a general confession, which is, you know, it's not just kind of your regular weekly job. This is a real house cleaning, you know, when you kind of go through your whole life and come up with everything you can possibly dredge up and, you know, really just try to make a clean breast with your past. And I did that, and he said two things to me. First of all was, Anders, I have never heard a confession that detailed in my entire life. And the second one was, now don't ever bring any of these things up again. Like he admonished me specifically, don't ever bring this up again. It's done. It's gone. It was a wonderful admonition to kind of start out in my early Catholic life with that advice. And I would give you the same. Confess it, get rid of it, move on, don't ever bring it up again. Not to yourself, not to a priest.
How freeing.
Absolutely.
All that is. Twyla, thanks for your call from Billings. Glad you're listening on our great partner there, Billings Catholic Radio. Called to communion here on EWTN. Thomas listening to us in Tennessee on the EWTN app. And Thomas, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, Dr. Anders, good to talk to you, sir. It's been about 6 months, actually, talked to you about my father last time we spoke, and he was cremated, and you gave me a lot of peace about it. I saw an article came out in our Middle Tennessee diocese about, I guess, the proper procedure for cremation was, someone dies, you bring the body to church for the funeral mass, then you cremate the remains after the mass, and then you do the burial. My dad, he'd received anointing the sick and apostolic pardon, but he was cremated, and then we had a mass form in, I guess, cremation. It was very reverent, but I was just curious, was Is that okay to have
yeah.
it like that?
That's fine.
Okay.
And it's not at all uncommon. I mean, there are churches that actually have a special kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, a sort of pallet.
Yeah.
Where you carry the cremated remains
I've seen that.
Into the church. You know?
Yeah.
And yeah, you're fine. You're fine. And I'm so sorry for the loss of your dad.
Thomas, thank you for checking in from Tennessee. Got a question here from Scott watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Why should someone become Roman Catholic and not Orthodox?
Yeah, well, I'm going to answer this in a kind of sort of platitudinous way at first, right? and then give it more detail. A person should become Catholic when they are persuaded in conscience that Christ founded the Catholic Church. Right?
Yeah,
if they're not persuaded in conscience that Christ founded the Catholic Church, they shouldn't become Catholic. And, well, I'm not persuaded, personally, that the Orthodox Church, as it is currently constituted, is according to Christ's constitution and design. Mm-hmm. I don't have that conviction, and so I could not in good conscience become Orthodox. If someone came to that conviction in good conscience, my position would be, well, I think their conscience is misinformed, but they should follow erroneous conscience and become Orthodox, right? I mean, the church says that we have an obligation to follow erroneous conscience, believe it or not, but try not to have an erroneous conscience,
yes.
right? You know, and so that's the simplest answer. Now, you know, some of the reasons personally that I came to the conviction that I was obligated in conscience to become Roman Catholic, I really would say Catholic because the Roman thing is sort of an afterthought. Like, I could just as easily have become Byzantine Catholic or, you know, Ruthenian Catholic or Syrian Catholic or Melkite Catholic
yeah, like,
or Maronite Catholic. I mean,
sure.
and I know Anglo dudes, you know, like Scotch-Irish guys from North America who convert to Catholicism and don't become Roman Catholic. I've known guys that have become Ruthenian Rite Catholics, for example, right? So they kind of, they demur from the Roman bit, right? The
sure.
Catholic part is the important part.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. But in my case, I mean, I think, first of all, that the papacy is a biblical institution. And that's really what it boils down to. You know, I mean, Christ said to Peter, you're on the rock, and on this rock I'll build my church. The gates of hell will not prevail against it. I give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth, bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth, loose in heaven. Whoever hears you, hears me. Feed my sheep. Strengthen my brethren, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when I look at the history of the institution, I find that, you know, there are Catholics East and West that acknowledge the unique primacy of the Bishop of Rome, right? I mean, this is not a uniquely Latin doctrine. This is an Eastern doctrine as well, all right, for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And so I'm essentially persuaded by that case. You know, there are some other sort of logical reasons as well. I mean, when I pose the question to myself, like I said about, well, which kind of Catholic would I become? Would I become Roman Catholic? Would I become a Ruthenian or a Melkite or whatever? Like, that variety presents itself to one differently if one is Orthodox in this way. But in Orthodoxy, it's not just a question of national churches, right, or of ethnic groups or ethnicities. There's actually different confessional organizations, right?
Mm.
There's different ways of construing Orthodoxy. So you could become a Byzantine Orthodox where you accept, you know, the Council of Chalcedon. You can become a Monophysite Orthodox where you reject the Council of Chalcedon. You can become an Assyrian Orthodox where you reject the Council of Ephesus, right? And these are not small differences. I mean, these are fundamental differences about the nature of God and Christ and our relationship to Him. And yet all these communions claim the mantle of Orthodoxy in antiquity. And I don't think there's a principled way to decide between them.
Yeah.
I mean, one can decide between them for ad hoc reasons, but I don't think there's any principled way because they all have the same argument, right? Ours is the original church. Ours is the Orthodox church. Ours is the church that clings to the real ecumenical councils. Well, how do you know which one is an ecumenical council? Well, that's the one that the real church affirms. Well, which one is the real church? Well, it's the one that affirms the ecumenical councils.
Circular.
I mean, there's a circular thing there that I don't think you can get out of, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, as a historical fact, the Byzantine Orthodox have the, you know, the greatest numerical representation, but that strikes me as a function of their having essentially derived from the Byzantine Empire. So there was a, you know, it was definitely a political thing there going on. You know, if you don't think that's the way God does business in history, you know, might makes right, then the other Orthodox also have a claim, right? I mean, on their own terms. I don't think they do relative to Catholicism. So I couldn't bring myself to make that jump, right? Now, I appreciate tons about Eastern Christianity. Tons. And the nice thing is, if you read Eastern polemics against Catholicism, and I have dipped my toe into that literature, what I have found is that most Eastern Orthodox theologians that write against Catholics write as if the only Catholics that existed were Roman Catholics, as if the only Catholics that existed were Latin Rite Catholics. And their criticisms are really aimed at the West. And, you know, to a certain extent, they will, like, acknowledge some of the early Latin fathers as belonging to their patrimony. You know, they're not of one mind on Augustine. They like things about Augustine. They don't like things about Augustine.
Uh-huh.
You know, they'll acknowledge some of the other Latin fathers. But as a Latin Rite Catholic, like, I don't feel that kind of ambivalence about the Eastern fathers. Like, they're my fathers, too.
Sure.
You know, so, like, you know, I kind of get to eat my cake and have it, too, if I'm a Latin Rite Catholic. Because, yeah, I have the whole Latin patrimony available to me as mine.
Yep.
Have the whole Eastern patrimony available to me as mine. Not in a, like, a sort of conquest sense that I own it and you don't, but this is the sort of the common patrimony of the Christian faith, and I can enrich my soul by its spirituality and traditions and liturgies, and all that is fully Catholic to me, as is St. Thomas or St. Augustine, right? So there's a kind of liberty of soul, a kind of greatness of soul that I experience in being Catholic. I'm not saying that I have a great soul. I have a rather pathetic soul, right? But, I mean, I have great resources available to my pathetic soul, right? And so, like, it's kind of a win-win for me being Catholic.
Sure. Scott, thanks for your question via YouTube this afternoon. Call to Communion here on EWTN. If you're new to EWTN, I'm proud to report that we offer the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass from Our Lady of the Angels Chapel live every morning at 8 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio and TV. And we can also send you a link to the Mass every day if you'd like. Visit EWTN.com, click on subscribe. That'll take you to a whole menu of things that you can subscribe to. Choose the Mass, you'll start getting that link right away. EWTN.com, click on subscribe. All right, back to it. Here is Gretchen, a first-time caller from South Dakota, listening on the great Real Presence Radio. Hi, Gretchen, what's on your mind today?
Hello, I have a question about general confession.
Yeah.
When you mentioned that, I went through a training last year that was an Ignatian training,
mm-hmm.
and it was recommended that we do a general confession, and I had already done a general confession, so I was wondering, when you said never confess those again, how does that work when they're encouraging you to do a general confession?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, if a person is given to scrupulosity, I would never advise them to do this, right? And certainly wouldn't advise multiple general confessions, because they can become quite scrupulous about it and it would be awful, right? If a person is not scrupulous, then there's more than one way you could handle this. Like, so one way would be to make a general confession of the things that you are aware of since your last general confession. Seems a little bit superfluous to me, because, I mean, supposedly you should have been taking care of all of that in your regular confessions, right? Now, I mean, to be fair, when you go to your confession, your regular confession, you're only obligated to confess your known mortal sins in kind and number. You don't have to confess venial sins.
Right.
Like, so if
right.
you could make a general confession and be a little bit more exacting in your self-examination, right, because your intent here is not just to sort of meet the canonical minimum. So that's one way you could handle it. There is a kind of, there's something called a devotional confession, which is a confession when you're not conscious of any grave sin. And it's just kind of an attempt to humble yourself before God and kind of reassert your creatureliness and your dependence upon Him and your reliance on the church for grace and this kind of thing. And again, I urge its use with caution, because there are just so many scrupulous people out there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And to over-confess by a scrupulous person can do them harm, right? So you got to be careful, right, with the devotional confession business. But if you're the right kind of soul, you have the right kind of disposition, I could see an occasion, and I'm not, this is, don't take this as advice, all right, where a person, you know, in that kind of disposition of just saying, you know, I know the kind of guy I am, I know the kind of thing I'm capable of, and, you know, this is what I was like when I was 20 years old, and thanks be to God, I'm not living that way now. You know, but I'm reminding myself of what I'm capable of, because I don't want to ever fall back there. You know, that kind of thing, you have a, you're a sort of limit. I mean, like, I'm hesitant to say go do that, right? You know, but I'm trying to put a generous construction on the advice and think, is there a reason why you would ever confess something more than once? I mean, technically, no, you shouldn't confess the same sin twice if it's been forgiven. But, you know, you could make allowances for, you know, a particular kind of spirituality, I suppose.
What about, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here, what if that general confession happened, let's say, in 1990?
Well, yeah.
You could confess everything that happened
from 1990 to now. Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah.
Gretchen, is that helpful for you?
Yes, it is. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We still have time for a few more calls if you want to give it a shot. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. This is probably one of the toughest emails I've ever seen. This is from a mom who calls herself SD. That's her initials. And this mom says, Dr. Anders, I lost my 31-year-old son, my dear son, to an accidental overdose. He was a practicing Catholic who went to church and reconciliation often. Still, he had this cross of addiction that seemed to take hold after his father's untimely death 5 years earlier. I am constantly in anguish, Dr. Anders, because I question if God permitted him into heaven in such a state as he was in at the time of his passing. Again, that's from SD.
I'm so sorry. I am so sorry. You might take some encouragement from the case of St. Mark G., and I'm so sorry, I do not know how to pronounce Mandarin, but I'm going to guess it's Tianjiang,
okay. All
right? So T-I-A-N-X-I-A-N-G, Mark G. Tianjiang, okay. If that's how you say it, okay? Who was a saint of the Catholic Church and a doctor who was an opium addict. And he was not able to break free from this addiction, but he struggled with it mightily his entire life, and he stayed in confession all the time, and he really fought the thing hard. And go look up his life, right, because it's an example of someone the church considers to have come to sanctity in spite of this addiction that was really more than they had the physical resources to handle. Right?
Yeah,
so there's
yeah.
a precedent for that sort of thing. And you know, from what I know about addiction, most people who, you know, no one goes in choosing to become addicted. No one does. And for most people, their first exposure to drugs and alcohol comes at a time in their life when they are really not capable of making informed choices about themselves or their health. I mean, for most people, it's going to be, you know, in adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
We know what good judges adolescents are,
oh,
right?
Man,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's because, you know, their peer environment put them up to this, and everybody else seems to be doing it. And well, hey, Johnny did it, and he got into Harvard, and you know, I mean, like all kinds of rationalizations and a lack of critical judgment, and you know, availability is the strongest predictor of drug use. Availability, right?
Yeah.
And then they wake up one day and realize, you know, this is more than I can handle, right? But you know how it is. I mean, like it is a learned habit, but it's a learned habit that makes deep, deep neurological ruts in the brain chemistry, right? That can be just cripplingly difficult to overcome. And I think our attitude should be one of deep compassion, right? And if that's our attitude, then why wouldn't God be compassionate?
Yes. SD, thank you so much for your heartfelt email there. Please know that we are praying for you as we pray for all of our listeners. Heard from Tennyson. Tennyson is watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Tennyson says, are demons and fallen angels, are they the same?
They are the same. They are the same. Yes, they are.
Okay. That's all there is to it.
That's right.
Okay. Here's a question now from, this is interesting. This is from Leo. Dr. Anders, why is my friend using the Bereans to justify the Bible alone position?
Oh, yeah, sure. Because when Paul preached to the Bereans, the book of Acts says that they were more noble than the Thessalonians because they examined the scriptures to see if the things that Paul said were true.
Okay.
All right. That's the text. That's all it says. That has absolutely nothing to do with the question of sola scriptura. Nothing whatsoever at all. So here's the difference. The Thessalonians held to the interpretation of the Bible that they had received from their fathers. And Paul came and offered them the message that Christ was the Messiah, and they responded by trying to kill him. All right? And then the Bereans did not respond by trying to kill Paul, but by instead testing the scriptures to see whether what Paul said was true. And then they adhered to the teaching of Paul, and they became believers and followers of Christ. That has nothing whatsoever at all to do with the question of sola scriptura, because first of all, what Paul preached to them was not in itself evident from the Old Testament. Paul makes that extremely clear, right? That the doctrine that God would reconcile the Gentiles to the Jews through Christ by faith. Paul says that was kept hidden from all ages and only revealed to God's prophets and apostles in the New Testament. And that he also teaches in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 that it was hidden from the fathers of the Old Covenant, only revealed in Christ. So you could not independently verify Paul's teaching simply by examining the scriptures that they had. So if you applied the doctrine of sola scriptura to what the Bereans actually had by way of sacred scripture, which would have been the Old Testament, and the principle was, don't believe anything Paul tells you unless we can independently verify every detail from the text of the Old Testament, then they could not have become Christians. Because the Old Testament does not tell you everything you need to know to become a Christian. It's impossible, right? What they did instead was see if Paul's teaching cohered with the Old Testament. Not if the Old Testament was sufficient to independently establish it, but did it cohere with the Old Testament? And it did. Then, unlike the Thessalonians, they accepted Paul's oral testimony about the teaching of Jesus. They accepted the oral tradition about Christ that went above and beyond what the Old Testament said, and they became believers. And they were more noble because they didn't try to kill him.
Well, there you go. Dennison, thanks so much for your question via YouTube. We have just enough time to get to Mary in Idaho watching us on YouTube as well. Hi, Mary. What's on your mind today? Mary in Idaho. Yes, go ahead, Mary.
Hi. Thank you, Dr. Anders, for letting me be on the show. I wanted to ask you, are the Orthodox who deny the Pope, can they be called Catholic too? I know there's different types of Orthodox, but a lot of people are saying that.
I appreciate the question.
In what way?
Yeah, sure. So the Catholic Church would not consider them Catholic. The Catholic Church would not consider those Orthodox to be Catholics. The Orthodox consider themselves to be Catholic. Like, they will use that word with respect to themselves, but we would not use that word to describe them, right?
Okay.
Because they've separated themselves from the Pope, right? Now, here's some things we would say positively about them. We say that they are a real church,
yes,
that they have real sacraments, that they have apostolic succession, that they are united to us in many, many ways, and that their distance from the Catholic Church is minuscule, right? That it wouldn't take much. It would, in the sense emotionally, it would take a lot. But, you know, like in terms of what doctrinal adjustments would have to be made for them to be in union, very few, right?
Okay.
Compared to any other religion on the planet. And so if the Catholic Church has the fullness of truth and sanctification and other communities have, you know, only elements, the Orthodox have almost all the elements. They're almost there.
So close.
Yeah.
There you go. And Mary, is that helpful for you? Mary, are you...
Yes. Is there any... Sorry, one more question. Is there any document that says that they're not Catholic? Just so I can be like, boom.
Boom. At my fingertips... You know, the documents of the Second Vatican Council are very good in describing the constitution of the Catholic Church.
Uh-huh.
So the statement on interreligious dialogue, Nostra Aetate, might be a place to look. Also, the Constitution on the Church, the dogmatic Constitution on the Church, Lumen Gentium, right? There's a great book on Rome and the Eastern Churches by Father Aidan Nichols, and
The
title is called Rome and the Eastern Churches. So you might look at all those resources.
Mary, thanks for checking in from Idaho. Glad we could get that call in at the end of the program. Dr. David Andrews, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
We do it right here Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Do check out our next program. That'll be tomorrow at this same time, 2 o'clock Eastern. Check out the podcast whenever you wish. And the podcast is at EWTN.com/radio. Then click on the words Podcast Central. Coming up next on most of these stations, it's Open Line Wednesday with Father Mitch. On behalf of our fantastic team here, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. See you tomorrow on Call to Communion. God bless.